right on schedule. And next up is Mike Ford from the Fisheries on review of Southern Resident Diet Information License.
Is it possible to get the computers back on the screen?
Let's see. So I just wanted, since a lot of the comments that we talked about earlier were related to kind of being precise about the diet information available that season, I thought I'd just briefly summarize this and also talk a little bit about some new information from sequencing of DNA samples that's not available at the last workshop. So in terms of data sources for seasonal variation, there was a lot of discussion of this in the prior workshops. Both John Ford and Brad Hansen gave really extensive presentations of the creation, scale sampling, and so forth. So I'm not going to review all that. I'm just going to kind of mention that the sort of data we have for seasonal variation are the frame remains, so these are scale and tissue samples following variation events, and then also information from fecal samples. And in that case, in order to get sense of species in those fecal samples, either based on PCR, presence absence of species, or some sort of quantification of species-specific DNA, either through PCR followed by cloning or PCR followed by high-throughput sequencing. So in terms of the methods of the cloning and or high-throughput sequencing, because I didn't go through that much last time, I'll just mention that briefly here. What you're after is trying to kind of determine the relative abundance of DNA sequences in a fecal sample of different sources. The way that works is you extract DNA from the fecal samples. In this case, they're usually pooled samples, homogenized and pooled samples from a period of several years. Then you amplify up a section of the mitochondrial genome. With primers that are designed to amplify all potential prey species, but designed specifically not to amplify killer whale DNA, so you don't want to do a little effort with killer whale DNA. And then you either clone and sequence individual PCR products, which result in a sample size of typically a couple hundred sequences per whole group of people samples, or you can label them and sequence them using high-throughput sequencing techniques. In this case, we use the 454 platform. Then you get typically several thousand sequences per sample. In terms of data analysis, in case of the sequencing we did, we ended up with actually closer to 50,000 individual DNA sequences. Those were quality filtered in various ways, and then compared to two different databases, both GenBank, which would have a very wide variety of species in it, and then we also align those to a custom database that just focused on fish prey species that would be available in the Pacific. So that would be salmon, of course, but also species of brown fish and other various fishes. And then you can get some kind of oddities in the next-gen sequence. So there's also some post-processing to spot kind of very oddball sequences that might be kind of mirrors of different species and so forth, particularly so on the right here, have a figure from a recent review paper of some of these methods, and I just kind of wanted to emphasize that there's potential sources of bias at kind of every point along this sequence of events, all the way from collecting the samples, which we've discussed in the past, might have certain diseases that are like this, or so forth, along with relative differences in, say, the density of mitochondrial. Mitochondria for a unit tissue from different species. You could have biases related to the digestion process, and then any number of sort of technical biases in the process of PCR amplification and so forth. And you can sort of do your best to kind of control for all those along the way. You can do controls, particularly on the lab side of things, to test for differences in PCR amplification and so forth. But at the end of the day, you can't actually, without doing certainly more controlled studies than we've been able to do, kind of have to treat these data with a little bit of a grain of salt and kind of more of a semi-quantitative evaluation of what's in the species, or certainly what's going in the animal, than a So in terms of sample sizes for the next-gen sequencing, we looked at a total of 319 PCs. And as I mentioned, we typically pooled samples within months. And here's kind of the samples per month. So in this case, we have kind of a low of 5 fecal samples from February, the high of over 45 samples from July. In two cases, August and September, we divided the samples up into different year groups. So, for example, this group of August samples is dominated by 2008 and prior years. This group of August samples is dominated by 2009 and a few subsequent years. So, in terms of results from the high throughput sequencing, this is basically what we get. We ended up with, like I said, about 45,000 sequences and about 4,000 to 9,000 sequences per pool fecal sample. And here's sort of results by month. So you can see that kind of as per past studies in the kind of late spring and through early to mid summer, sort of nearly entirely Chinook in the disease based on this method. As you get into later summer, August and September, you see a transition to some other species. Sockeye, in the case of August here, and Coco, in the case of September. And then you get kind of fall, October, November, December, you transition to something like most of the chum, but also some other species of the Chinook. A few samples that we have. From winter in February here, these are samples from Puget Sound area in this case, where most of them have been similar to the late summer or fall samples. So how does that compare with what you've sort of seen before from the earlier summers? The bottom panel here is the same figure that I just showed you. That's the high-throughput sequencing. The one above it is basically the same sort of analysis based on cloning and sequencing. So it's the similar type of method. And then here's the relative creation data from Southern Northern residents compiled by both DFO and NOAA. These are all Southern resident measured here, and then Northern residents, John Ford at the top. And the overall pattern here, again, is quite similar between the different methods. Basically, the analysis of the PCs show pretty much the same pattern that you see. Analysis of predation events and scales. And the two populations are also fairly similar in that you have this kind of domination of Chinook in the spring and summer, followed by this transition in the fall to other species, maybe a slightly earlier transition in the case of other northern residents than the southern residents. In terms of winter samples, John Ford covered this really extensively in the last workshop. There are a number of coastal examples from both northern and southern residents, as well as some inland samples. So the total sample size is more like the order of a dozen or so. I should just mention just for clarification, February is for the fecal samples, just for ease of presentation, including samples from January to March, in case of the case of predation events. In terms of variation on years, using this method, again, here's 2005 to 2008, and 2007. For the August samples, you can see that there's some variation, 80% to 93% there, of those 2 years, the remainder, in this case, being mostly sockeye. It is interesting that in this set of years here, that didn't include a high sockeye region in 2006. That's the only high sockeye year that we have in the data set. And then also quite a bit in September, there's more variation ranging from 70 to over 90% Chinook, depending on the choice of years. There was a question of age of the Chinook by season, and John presented a lot of that in the last workshop, and I didn't have a chance to compile all of his data for this, but this is the data from the NOAA samples from the Salish Sea areas. You can see it's using many times for during the summer period, it's dominated by green, salt, which is just a weird interage. And you see for the few late fall samples, you do definitely see some younger sugar cane consumed. I don't have it up here, but the data that John presented at the last workshop for more of the coastal and more northern winter samples were mostly older sugar cane. So just to summarize, based on that seasonal variation, so there's a total of more than 1,000 total creation events if you combine all the data together, and more than 300 fecal samples, although, again, most of those are collected in this June to October period. Overall, based on these data, you see really almost entirely Chinook in July. You see a transition in August and September where it's still mostly Chinook, but there are other species as well, but less on that. October to December, mostly chum. It's still some of the species present. And then January to March, there's only a handful of samples, but those samples that are there are mostly chum. Run residents and southern residents are very similar. Those patterns, you know, the different methods that we do, the same. Thank you. So that's a good question. So in terms of the people samples, they were for the southern residents, they are all collected from the range. So even the winter samples, for example, are from Puget Sound, some of the data that John presented last time in terms of predation events in the winter, some of those were from the outer coast. So there's a smattering of samples on the outer coast that most of the data is
just to follow up on that, thinking about the winter samples, were they taken during a time period when there were just a few individuals hanging around in proximity to the sapling, whereas most of the population had taken off and gone elsewhere? I'm just wondering if the winter diets are biased away from what the overall population is doing in the winter time.
Yeah, I don't think there's a good way to answer that. The Puget Sound sample certainly not necessarily representative of the entire population. It was a subset of the population. So we certainly do somewhat different things in terms of the relative time that it's spent on the coast. So the degree that you think their diet would be different on the coast, yeah. I would not call the inland samples of Puget Sound necessarily representative of what they do. We don't have a lot of direct data. Yeah, great.
I think one of the most interesting features is the rather strong switch to chum in the fall, and then the apparent switch back to Chinook. In some sense, easy to understand that the chum come in as they return, they're pretty vulnerable. And because, at least my understanding is that the winter distribution of chum is not particularly coastal. You know, the only time they can get a chum is when they are coming in to return. And so, in one hand, it suggests they're actually pretty opportunistic. When big bunches of chum are there, they'll feed on them, but it doesn't explain to some extent why. Say other coastally oriented species like coho aren't in the particularly in the winter diet. They just didn't seem to show much at all, right?
Yeah. Well, again, bear in mind that at least for the people sample, the winter diet is from Puget Sound. So again, and I mean Puget Sound, real Puget Sound, like off Seattle. And so in terms of what would be available there in December. Yeah.
And to clarify, I'm over here. Just to clarify once again, during that time period when most of the killer whales have left Puget Sound, so you have a sample of diets in an area where really the only prey is Chinook, but most of the killer whales have moved elsewhere.
Yeah, they do not in the October through December time period. If you kind of average the whale days and so forth. Spending maybe 20% of their time elsewhere. I'm not claiming to know what they're eating out there, other than what John presented at the last workshop. And many of those predation events were from out of coastal areas. And so, to the degree that there are data available, they were also being shown in those areas. Then, of course, we have the famous two samples from the Washington.
Other questions?
We've got John.
Oh, yeah, Mike. Just curious. Are fecal samples that were collected in inside waters during summer, as you mentioned, in winter they're quite down in the summer. But I'm just curious whether you looked at the fecal samples that were collected right after an excursion to the outer coast during the summer to see whether basically. Transporting what they need out there back in people's samples that you've got them inside. So you look at that to see if there's any difference in the prey composition.
Yeah,
and after they return from the
time. Not really. We haven't looked at it that fine. Most of the, in part because of budgetary considerations and wanting to kind of maximize the use of the high throughput sequencing we're doing, we tend to combine fecal samples so that we can kind of get an average of what they're doing with particular time periods. So we haven't tried to like identify those particular set of samples that are specifically from the live just kind of. We did get, I should mention also, someone mentioned Elvin as well earlier, and we did, we have not tried to quantify the level of DNA. But there was shown detected in health, but not detected in those samples.
Just a comment about the opportunities. If they're really opportunistic, wouldn't we expect a lot more sockeye to be in the
Well, that's another good question. So one of the kind of interesting things about the next-gen sequencing results is we do see more sockeye in those data than we have in the past. So in the predation events, there's been a few sockeye that's been really low levels, as you say, kind of lower than you'd expect. We actually, for the next-gen sequencing, you can see it there. We did get almost 20% sockeye. And was set of samples, which included the one kind of high sockeye here that we had available. So I don't know, there's actually a little more evidence in these data that they're consuming sockeye than we've seen previously. Whether it's still out of proportion to the relative abundance of the two species that you see, particularly in the high sockeye.
I think we have a comment here and then.
Just a comment with respect to the October to December Puget Sound sampling. All three pods were generally in the area at that time, and probably the collection data could be looked at to see which pod samples are confident. I don't know, but that.
Hi, Tim Tynan, the Elevation Summer. You mentioned that 2006 was the lone high socket abundance year we had, and actually 2010 was our world record socket return.
We don't have any
samples for that. That particular bar, then.
Yeah, we don't. Unfortunately, if you look at the sample sizes, we have very few samples from 2010. In fact, we have no samples from 2010 from those months, unfortunately.
Okay, that's bad. And just following up on a comment from Ray, the North Ocean Fish Commission conducted first-thing test fisheries at Albuquerque Point Area 10 during the hemp season to get a season updated from science on Puget Sound chub salmon. They have good data on species mix and size. There are chub salmon in their abundance in some years, black one, during the time that the chum are returning in the summer, quite large fish. Mix of, 5 to 10 months. You might look into that data.